Welcome in to the 48 Minutes Podcast on Believe, presented by Bet Online. I'm Ross Geiger, joined alongside Bruce Bernstein of Pure Hoops Media, World B Michael Freer, and soon we'll also be joined by special guest Amin El Hassan. This is episode number 89, the Lou Amundsen episode, as Lou wore number 89 as a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers during the 2015 NBA season. Before we give our special guest the proper introduction, just a quick reminder that BetOnline continues to be your number one source for all your basketball wagering needs, including pro and college hoops throughout the year. With up-to-the-minute odds, stats, trends, you can follow your favorite team's path to the playoffs with in-game live betting, contests, and all the best player props. Experience the world's best wagering platform anytime from your desktop or your mobile devices. Head to BetOnline today to become part of the team, and remember to use our promo code BLEAV, that is B-L-E-A-V, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, the game starts here.
Amin El Hassan is Darth Amin on X Twitter, or is it Twitter X? Not quite sure. His Star Wars obsession started at a very young age, but I digress. We'll hopefully get to that in a moment. Amin is one of the brightest and smartest basketball minds in the NBA family. He's been in the Phoenix Suns front office. He was my colleague at ESPN, where we started working together on NBA Tonight and other shows. He's become one of the kings of hoop media. He's on SiriusXM NBA Radio. He co-hosts the Oddball podcast with Charlotte Wilder on the DraftKings Network. And he was the very first hire when Dan Lebatard and company launched Meadowlark Media. He's smart. He's funny. He's dialed in 100%. Thank you for chilling with us on 48 Minutes, Amin.
No problem. And as one of my children just barges in and knocks over some of the lighting, no knocks, nothing. Nothing. Parent life, you got to love it.
Can you go, like, you know, put Star Wars on a monitor or something? I mean, you know, I want to know first things first. How did your introduction to the Star Wars culture begin? And have you turned your kids into Star Wars consumers as well?
So for me, I think it was I saw Return of the Jedi in the theater, probably in 1983. So I probably was around 4 years old. And as you can imagine, that was a pretty transformative experience, Ewoks and droids and everything. And then I remember, like, this is back when, all right, for the younger listeners, we had these things called VCRs. And so what you did was when you knew something was going to come on TV, you know, they're like, oh, this Friday on ABC at 7 p.m., Star Wars. You just get like some cassettes ready and be waiting at 7 p.m. to hit record and pause during the commercials. And now you had Star Wars or whatever movie you wanted on cassette. And so I had Star Wars on cassette. So when my family moved from New York to Sudan, given that there was a dearth of entertainment options, we had a bunch of cassettes of just stuff that we taped, TV shows and movies and even sports. And I just watched those tapes over and over again. And one of those tapes was the original Star Wars. So that's where it started. And then obviously it grew from there. And then as far as my kids, yes, they're all indoctrinated. So,
yeah. So, did you hit record right at the beginning of the movie or did you roll a little bit late on it? Is there a story there?
Yeah. So the, the funny thing about that first Star Wars tape, that New Hope, was we missed the start of the movie. So we hit record right when we turned it on, which was when Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker show up to the cantina to hire Han Solo. So like the first 25 minutes of the movie, I just missed all of that. And to this day, when I watch Star Wars and that the first 25 minutes comes up, it always feels very new and fresh to me in a weird way. Like, oh, my God. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Like Darth Vader does meet up with Princess Leia on the ship. And so that is a fun thing. Like I can my brain, my muscle memory immediately clicks as soon as the guy says to Luke Skywalker, he doesn't like your face. I don't like your face. We're wanted men. Like, oh, that's where my memories start, right there.
That's awesome, wow. Amin, and we appreciate you joining us here. And speaking of new and fresh, we've got some fresh faces in new places with the NBA trade deadline happening last week. Of course, I think it's safe to say the New York Knicks were probably the winners on deadline day, having acquired both the Pistons forwards Bojan Bogdanović and Alec Burks, and also had a previously acquired OG Anunoby from the Raptors. So just wanted to get your thoughts on kind of the nucleus in New York now. Is this a team we can now consider maybe top three in the East with some of the Bucks struggles?
Yeah, I mean, I think top three, yes. That's definitely, you can pencil that in between them and the Celtics and the Cavaliers. The Bucks struggles obviously factor into that, but I think people need to recognize this Knicks team is legitimately good. You know, a year ago, earlier this season, I talked about this, but I started talking about this a year ago, where the Knicks had an internal civil war of ideologies, right? And on the one hand, you had the players that were thinking the game and playing the game based off IQ and decision-making. And then you had the other half of the locker room was impulse guys. Guys, I got it going. I feel good. And ultimately, you can survive and be successful and thrive with an impulse guy. You can't do it when half your locker room is like that. And that's where they were. And we saw that last year during the playoffs when they lost to the Heat. They lost because they didn't know how to execute. The Heat were not more talented than the Knicks, but they were a team that knew how to execute, and they were a thinking man's team, whereas the Knicks were kind of engulfed with this impulse play. And there's no better example of that than, I believe it was game one, where Jimmy Butler gets hurt. Or I can't remember. It was one of the games up in the Garden. Jimmy Butler gets hurt, rolls his ankle. He can barely move. He's not coming out the game, though. And the Knicks go maybe like 8 or 9 possessions in a row, and nobody ever says, let's attack the hurt guy off the dribble. They kept going somewhere. And that's a perfect example of impulse play. I feel it. Just give me the ball. Let me get a shot up. Not like, wait a second. Hold on. Everybody go over there. You come over here, set the screen. So he's going to have to switch. And we're playing the chess game, the game within the game, as Pat Riley called it a long time ago. So what they've done quietly was reduce the impulse guys and increase the number of IQ guys. So it starts with, you go out and you sign Dante DiVincenzo in the offseason. And then you go and get OG Anunoby. And then some of it is by happenstance, right? Some of it works where you send out RJ Barrett, you send out Emmanuel Quickley, two impulse guys, and you get back a real thinking man's guy in OG Anunoby. Some of it is by luck. Mitchell Robinson, tremendous rebounder, tremendous shot blocker, a little bit of an impulse guy. He gets hurt. Who has to play a lot more now? Isaiah Hartenstein, more of an IQ guy, more of a, where am I? Am I in the right place at the right time? Am I? And then, you know, offensively, where am I on the floor to make everybody else's life easier? So what the Knicks have become is, okay, we got Julius Randle as our impulse guy, and then everybody else on the floor knows what they're doing. And now, this trade deadline, you add Bogdanović and Alec Burks, two more guys that are more on that IQ side, although also maybe longer in the tooth as well.
Hey, I mean, one team that their biggest deadline deal was really at the head coach position, that being the Milwaukee Bucks, when they made the coaching change and brought in Doc Rivers. I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on what the problem has been for the Bucks this season? And do you think they can turn it around in time as we're getting down to the last 30 games of the season? Do you think they can turn it around and become that favorite that we thought they were going to be before the season?
Right. So I would say there are three issues with the Bucks. One was, obviously, everyone saw it, their defense was or has been horrendous. Now, a lot of people point to, well, they lost Jrue Holiday. What do you expect? I expect the defense not to be as good. I didn't expect it to be horrendous. So how can you say that? Well, you've got Giannis Antetokounmpo, former defensive player of the year winner, who's in his prime. And you've got Brook Lopez, runner-up in defensive player last year. And typically, when you look at team defenses, they're predicated by bigs, not wings, not perimeter players. I'm not saying that those guys don't have an impact. I'm not saying that those guys don't matter. But if you're saying, hey, I need to keep this team defense going, I would say, well, let me make sure my all-world defensive big is available and healthy. Now, what if I told you I have two of those and they're both available and healthy and we're still in the bottom 10 in the league of defense? I would say there's something more going on there than personnel issue. Number two, offensively, they made this huge move to get Damian Lillard. They have not, as of yet, unlocked the Damian Lillard Giannis Antetokounmpo combo. In math, basketball is a game of math, but it's a game of funny math in that 1 + 1 sometimes equals 2, sometimes equals 3, sometimes equals 1. What I mean by that is, on the outside, on paper, you say, I have a great perimeter offensive player in Damian Lillard. I have a great inside guy in Giannis Antetokounmpo. Those two guys, if they do their own thing and never interact, he'll score 25, he'll score 30, we'll get 55 points of production on roughly 50 to 55% shooting from the field. All right, cool. Ideally, it's not just they're doing their own thing. There's a symbiosis that's happening. So if you think of like Jamal Murray and Jokic, that's an example of 1 + 1 = 3, maybe even 4, because the way they interact with one another and the way they play off of one another grows each other's game. I score more. I'm a better offensive player because I play with him and he makes my life easier and vice versa. And then there's the case of we just don't mesh at all and we're not taking advantage of anything. And that's when you get 1 + 1 = 1. That's what the Bucks have been at, where it's like, I got these two great guys. Somehow it's not adding up to what it should be, which is an unstoppable offense. It's a good offense because those guys are good, but it's not unstoppable. So they haven't done that. The defense has slipped. The offense is not unlocked to the levels it needed to. And then the third thing is identity. I just don't think they know who they are. They don't play like a team that knows who they are or who they what they hang their hat on or anything like that. And so much of that is ingrained in NBA basketball and success, of people knowing their roles and embracing them and being stars within those roles, whether they are actual stars or just role players. And so I think when you take all three of those things, you get a team that on talent is winning games, but overall has a lot of work to do.
Well, you know, one of the big moves that they made was bringing in your close personal friend, Patrick Beverley, yeah, to bolster their defense. And in their game against Denver on Monday night, the Nuggets are at 68 points and we're already in early in the fourth quarter. So, yeah, so far that's working out. But I want to ask you about another noted dog who changed teams. We're going to go out in the Western Conference. Royce O'Neal goes to Phoenix. To mm-hmm. me, that is just an ideal pickup for Phoenix.
Yep.
A dog on defense. And if you leave him open, he can make a three. I mean, he can be a little streaky. That, to me, seems like a very under-the-radar, huge move out west.
Well, considering also they gave up a bunch of guys that, no disrespect, I don't think are rotation NBA players, right? And those guys were getting rotation minutes in Phoenix. So it's almost like there's two benefits to this deal. One benefit is, hey, we got Royce O'Neal. He's a pretty good role player, a guy who understands why he's in this league and where he fits in a team like this. The other part is, we got rid of guys that, for whatever reason, Coach Vogel felt like he had to play. And that sometimes you got to help the coach out by taking the decision out of his hands. And I think Chimezie Metu and Keita Bates-Diop and Yuta Watanabe, these were all guys that if that was a 10th guy and it was just one of them, then you're all right with it. But the problem is those guys were forced into 7, 8, 9 roles where they're playing every night, playing serious minutes against serious lineups. And I think you see some of the issues there. Now, Bol Bol obviously being healthy makes that deal a lot easier. They can say, hey, I can torch these guys because I got this big over here who I do trust in, who I do believe in. But again, just getting them out of there is going to help them. And getting Royce O'Neal, who, as I said, is a guy who knows what he's there for, that's going to help them tremendously.
Now, I mean, shifting to the Oklahoma City Thunder here, of course, they have all the draft capital in the world, could have been extremely creative at the deadline to make a big splash. They did get a big name who, of course, hasn't been playing the last couple of seasons much, and that's Gordon Hayward. Mm-hmm. And then just recently, they went out and used the buyout market to sign Bismack Biyombo. Now, mm-hmm. If you ask me right now, I think Biombo is going to have more of an impact right away than Gordon Haywood would to be on this team. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on whether or not you think Haywood's actually going to make an impact on this team, or is that just yet to be determined since there's a lot of unknowns with him?
So Bruce is going to love this one. This is a throwback. The instructions say bake the cake at 400 degrees for 40 minutes. That doesn't mean I can crank it up to 800 and get it done in 20. You got to bake the cake at that temperature for as long as the recipe requires. When we look at the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think we see a team brimming with talent, a team that has a lot of different things addressed, playmaking, shooting, defense, maybe a little thin on the size. But for the most part, they have very few weaknesses on paper. Their biggest weakness, we don't have a lot of experience. We don't have a lot of grit. When you look at the guys that have actually played in the playoff game, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has a handful as a backup. Lu Dort has a handful that was in a bubble. Bertans got traded. He had a handful, though. So it's like they don't have a lot. Most of these other guys, the old saying goes, it ain't my first time at the rodeo. This is their first time at the rodeo. And everything in NBA history has told us that when it's your first time at the rodeo, you get the horns a lot. Very rarely do you become the rodeo clown that came out unscathed and said, hey, first time, and I was awesome at it, right? Usually, when you have a team that's overwhelmingly inexperienced, they get punched in the mouth by an older team, and that's their growing pains, and then they learn from it and they move on. We've seen it with the Oklahoma City Thunder a decade ago. 2010, they make the playoffs as an 8 seed, and they lose to the Lakers, I believe, in the first round. And it's a gritty first-round series, but clearly they just didn't know what they were doing. The next year, they go to the playoffs, and the year after that, they go to the finals, right? It goes upward, right? Because you need that experience. Now, when you don't have that experience as a collective, it helps to have someone who's been there. Gordon Hayward's been there. Bismack Biyombo's been there. They may not play a minute, but having them there to talk these guys through these growing pains that are inevitable is important, and it is of worth. And so I say to you, I look at this team and I say, this team could be the best team in the league next year. They're damn close now. They could be the best team in the league next year. Why would I break that up, all these young players who can play together and grow together? Give me DeJounte Murray right now. Is that going to change things? Is that going to move the needle? Maybe we'll win. We'll get to the second round. But the reality is, if we're trying to do this thing extended and sustained, their best bet is to keep this group together. And so how do I add along the perimeter to help, or the fringes, excuse me, the periphery, to help these guys grow up, basically?
Well, you know, that's where a guy like Hayward, you know, on the team mm-hmm. bus and practice in the locker room, yep. whatever.
Video, yep, all of it.
Exactly. You know, it's like, here are the mistakes that I made, and I'm telling you guys, so maybe you can avoid them. And, you know, that's what leadership on the team, you know, does for you. Boston had a kind of an interesting couple of transactions prior to the deadline. Right now, I mean, they look like a team that could go wire to wire. And adding Xavier Tillman gives them a young, solid big off the bench. It'll help Porzingis and Horford yeah. stay fresh for the playoffs. And they've got this nice cushion in the standings right now. So they really have a chance to give Porzingis some nights off. And because, look, they're only going to go as far as a healthy Porzingis takes them in the postseason. Mm. If he's hurt, you know, they're the same as they were last year, maybe not even as good. So that was a pretty under the radar, you know, Michigan State guy, heads mm-hmm. up player, good teammate. What was your impression? How significant do you think Tillman going to Boston is?
Bruce, I'll tell you, I said that's the move that gives Brad Stevens executive of the year for me. And I know that's not an award that the media votes on. I believe the other execs vote on it, but to get Xavier Tillman for pennies. And that's a good player. That is a good rotation player. When the season started, I said the biggest issue I have with the Celtics is I don't believe in their depth outside of Horford. Sorry, Bruce. I'm not a Peyton Pritchard guy. I'm not a Sam Hauser guy. I'm not a Kata guy. I'm definitely not a Luke Kornet guy. I think again, kind of like Phoenix. Like if you told me any one of those guys, like that's my ninth man, I'm like, great. When you say that's my seventh man, now I'm worried. And then Al Horford is my sixth man, and he's 800 years old. God bless him. Still going, but he's up there. So that was one. One was depth. Two was particularly depth at the forward position, at the big position, the big spot. Because Robert Williams, who of course we now know is hurt and done, but he was huge for them in the last couple of years. And to kind of hang your hopes on Porzingis, who also has a history of not being physically available at all times, I thought it was just incredibly risky. But they went out and they got a rotation NBA player, a rotation big, a guy that I think, I don't know how many teams knew he was available, because I'm surprised he went for as low as he did. Xavier Tillman is a really good player. And, you know, if you've watched Memphis games, particularly Memphis playoff games recently, he's kind of their big off the bench, especially when Brandon Clark kind of got hurt. He's gotten a lot of reps. So I think the Celtics did very well for themselves there. Now, ultimately, the place I disagree with you on is Porzingis is important for sure. And Tillman is important. And that depth is important. But ultimately, Brown and Tatum have to play like stars. They can't have the disappearing acts that they had last year against the Heat, the year before against the Warriors. I think at the end of the day, we can help them. We can surround them with guys that, you know their roles and play well. But ultimately, the failures of not being able to overcome squarely landed on our stars were not stars. It's not like our stars were stars and then we let them down with poor role player play. Our stars weren't stars.
Now, well, I'm sorry. Just one real quick point. Jrue Holiday has made an enormous difference in there. He's kind of some like of that panic insurance late in games. Mm-hmm. When you put the ball in his hands, where it used to be Jaylen Brown would dribble into a crowd and turn the ball over, now it seems that there's a little bit more stability back there with Jrue. But anyway, I know I didn't mean to step on you there, Ross.
Oh, you're good.
Sorry about that, guys.
No, I was just getting excited here because I want to shift gears here to teams that stood pat at the deadline. And I mean, I really like that analogy about being in the kitchen baking something. So let's get right back into that mindset here. What on earth are the Chicago Bulls baking in their kitchen?
Needs to a lot of it. You know, and it's funny. It's an organization that has been at this crossroads so many times. I think I remember Bruce on NBA Tonight, me telling Cassidy Hubbard, if the Bulls know what they're doing right now, trade Powell, trade Joakim Noah, trade them all now because you're not going anywhere. These players aren't getting better. They're all older players. This is the end of the road. Get something for it. Salvage it. Get a head start on the future. And they didn't. They held on to those guys. And those guys all left as free agents, and they had nothing to show for it. And so fast forward, here we are again. You got Alex Crusoe. Teams were interested. You have DeMar DeRozan. Teams were interested. You might even have teams interested in Patrick Williams, who has had an up and down career. They had an opportunity to say, look, we tried something. It was hinging on Lonzo Ball being healthy and available. He hasn't been. He may never play again. We have to move on. And instead, they said, you know what? Maybe we will do this play-in thing again and have our hearts broken in the play-in. By the way, games that don't count. I don't know if you guys know that, right? Yeah. In terms of stats, in terms of records, the NBA does not keep it. It simply exists just to figure out who's going to be the 7 and the 8 seed and who's going to be the 14 and the 13 pick in the draft or at least at the lottery. So there's no pride in saying we went to the play-in every year. If you don't get out of it, it's worthless. And if you get out of it and get your heads bashed in, it's similarly worthless unless you're a young team. I always say this. If I'm a young team, making the playoffs as an 8 seed or a 7 seed is always a good thing because I'm getting my guys that experience we talked about with Oklahoma City earlier. It matters. It counts. If I'm crawling to get into the 8 seed with vets and older guys, look, could a Miami thing happen again? On paper, yes. But the reality is, you're just wasting everybody's time. These guys are older guys, it's not like next year they're going to take this experience and it's going to lift them to higher heights. Like, this is who they are. And this is probably the last time they'll be who they are. So holding on to vets just doesn't make sense. Vucevic, Caruso, DeRozan. I don't think any of us think these guys next year, oh my God, we went to the playoffs and the guy realized he could really do this. And they're not taking leaps. They are who they are. And so this team, as constructed, is exactly what it is, a 7-10 team that at best gets its head bashed in a playoff series and at worst what happened last year. So,
and oh, by the way, what the heck is Andre Drummond still doing on their roster?
That should have
been the first guy traded, according to Ross and World B last week.
For sure, because here's the deal. Caruso, under contract, it's non-guaranteed next year, but he's good. They're not going to waive him. So you might say, okay, I want to keep him around for what's next. DeMar DeRozan, we have his bird rights. We can pay him more than anyone else. We really love having him around here. There's an argument to say, hey, we're going to figure out our team next year, and we'll pay DeMar DeRozan to stay. And DeMar might say, you know what? For this money, I'm not going to get this anywhere else. Yeah, I will stay. Andre Drummond was a minimum player. He's playing really well. He's not coming back. He's not coming back. Trust me. Even if you say, we'll pay him, you're limited as a team that has his non-bird rights, which is what they call it when you play for a team for 1 year. Play for a team for 1 year, they have your non-bird rights. Play for a team for 2 years, they have your early bird rights, which gives you a little bit more flexibility in how much you can pay. Play for a team 3 years, now they have your full bird rights and they can go up to max if they want, right? Andre Drummond is going to be a non-bird player, meaning like you can offer him like a 20% raise over minimum. He's not coming back for that. And so unless you're going to devote serious cap space towards him, meaning you're going to make yourself flexible enough to give him that, which doesn't make sense. Andre Drummond's played well, not well enough to break the bank for. You trade him. You say, you know what, man? We'll have to figure out how to make the play-in without him and get this extra asset.
Now, another team you wanted to talk about that more or less stood still there were the Lakers. Now, I texted Ross during Saturday night's Suns Warriors game, and I texted him, said, hey, two teams I'm not sleeping on the rest of the season are the Warriors and the Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
But the Lakers go in to add Spencer Dinwiddie off waivers and everything. What are your thoughts on the Lakers going forward and the Dinwiddie signing, how that could help that team?
This is another classic that I'm sure Bruce will appreciate. It's adding Dinwiddie helps in the same way that saying, like, right now I'm however many hundreds of thousands of miles away from the moon, right? Now I've stood up. I'm closer. Technically, I am closer to the moon. I stood up. I was here. Now I'm here. No, again, Spencer Dinwiddie is the type of player who can help a team that's right there on the cusp. He can't help a team that is languishing where the Lakers languish. The reason why we don't count them out is because we're saying we don't count out LeBron. It's not about Jared Vanderbilt and Prince and D'Angelo Russell. We're saying we don't count out LeBron. In the same way for the Warriors, we're not saying we don't count out the Warriors. We're saying we don't count out Steph Curry. We believe, you know, as we saw on Saturday night, that give me Steph Curry with the ball and let us just be close, and I think we can pull it out. And again, Miami has given everyone this hope that, hey, if I have a team of proven people who've been to the promised land or near it, I'll trust them in a seven-game series. And to be honest with you, in the Western Conference, if you are a play-in team that is a veteran-laden play-in team, this is the year to be that. Because you look at 1-2, and I know the Clippers have dropped out and keep dropping in, but when you look at Minnesota and Oklahoma City as two of the three teams that have occupied those top two spots for most of the year, not a lot of playoff metal. Minnesota a little bit more, obviously, behind Anthony Edwards and Karl-Anthony Towns and Kyle Anderson, Mike Conley, and those guys. Guys who have been around a little bit more, but your best players Edwards and Towns, again, very light on playoff experience. If I'm the Lakers or I'm the Warriors, I'm saying, look, man, we'll do to them what we did to Sacramento last year, what we did to Memphis last year. Like, we'll show them you guys don't know anything about all the old man tricks. So on the one hand, I see, like, I'm like, yo, you guys needed help, and I don't know if you got any of the help. On the other hand, I see how they believe in themselves, saying, just get my old guys healthy and to a place where they can compete, and I'll bank on our experience over the talent of those higher seeds.
Now, I mean, World B just said that he is obviously keeping an eye on the Warriors and the Lakers during the stretch run. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you the same question. Who do you have your eye on in the NBA for the stretch run of this regular season? And it doesn't have to be a hot take, dark horse, but what are the teams that you're really narrowed in on right now and want to see what they can do?
So in the East, it's the Knicks. Yeah. I think, you know, obviously now they're going through some injury stuff, and whenever we answer these questions, ladies and gentlemen, we're always assuming health. If the health isn't there, then none of this matters. But I think the Knicks, like I said, they've really answered and solved a lot of their problems. I think there's not a dominant team in this league. I think everyone's got flaws and vulnerabilities. And so it leaves the door open for a team to get hot at the right time. And the Knicks have a lot of shooting, so they have an opportunity. They've given themselves now an opportunity to get hot. If that's the case, the Knicks in the East, and in the West, I mean, the Clippers have been the best team in the league over the last 35 games. And I keep hearing sure people have. Say, oh, it's the Clippers. I mean, both of those teams, the Clippers and the Knicks,
Yeah. They've
earned the right for people to be skeptical. But I'm watching them play. Guys, I don't think this is your uncle's Knicks and Clippers. I think this is a different monster altogether. And for the Clippers, especially given that they're healthy, because that's really been the biggest issue they've had over the last 5 years, is just, you know, since this Paul George, Kawhi Leonard thing started, it's like, can we get them healthy at the same time? Now they got them healthy, and Harden healthy, and Russ healthy, and Norm Powell, and, you know, Terrence Mann. And by the way, as good a center rotation as any team in the league that doesn't have Embiid or Jokic. When you talk about Tice, Plumlee, and Zubac, all three of those guys are high level, not stars. They're not stars. But when you talk about guys I can throw out there and I can trust that'll do what they're supposed to do and not play outside themselves, it gets no better than those three right there. So the Clippers are deep and they're experienced. And as long as they're healthy, I think you have to take them seriously.
Absolutely. And with that, I mean, we've reached the halftime buzzer. So we're going to take a quick break and come back for the second half.
And welcome back, everybody. That was a nice quick break. Hopefully we sold something during that commercial spot there. as we begin the third quarter, Monday, February 12th would have been Bill Russell's 90th birthday. Now, I grew up a Celtics fan. I attended my first game in 1966, believe it or not, when Russell was still pretty much near the top of his game. The story of his relationship with former Celtics coach Red Auerbach went well beyond player and coach. It was a collaboration, really, between two men who were not afraid to challenge conventional wisdom at a time when doing so cost them. Russell called out racism and worked to combat hatred, playing in a city that had its share of both. But the example that he set of empowerment and leadership will be long remembered. And for me, growing up a Celtics fan, I was affected by him at a very young age with his whole way of carrying himself and how he stood up for social causes. And in many ways, you know, it's something that I still feel guided by in a lot of ways. So, I mean, what are your thoughts? I mean, you know, Bill Russell, I know you did a show on Sirius XM radio over the weekend. I listened to some of it. I don't know if that was recorded right when shortly after his death. But I really enjoyed some of your takes on Bill Russell. And I'm just, you know, tell us what Bill Russell means to you after, you know, everything, you know, on his 90th birthday.
Yeah, you know, we tend to dwell on his basketball accomplishments, and rightfully so. He's the winningest player pretty much in the history of our sport, if not all major American professional sports. But when you look into kind of the impact he had on the civil rights movement, not just as being a proud, outspoken black man in a time when that was hazardous to your health, to say the least, actual work with the civil rights leaders of the day, with the Martin Luther Kings, with the Malcolm X's and the people who were responsible for many of the advancements in civil rights at the time, using his platform at a time when that wasn't even a thing that people did, regardless of what your cause was, unless it was just kind of like buy T-bills or whatever the country line was. So for him to do that, to lay a blueprint out for anyone with a platform to feel comfortable being active and advocating for the rights of the oppressed and the less fortunate. And then, oh, by the way, also being one of the best to ever do it. I mean, it's like a handful of guys that we can say that about in history. Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Harry Belafonte, you know, Sam Cooke. These were guys that were, hey, I'm really doing a lot for the cause. Oh, by the way, in my spare time, I'm one of the best to ever do it. And the number of guys who've done that is a lot smaller than the number of guys who just went out there and said, look, I just want to make songs or make movies or hit a jump shot. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think people get in the trouble of trying to conscript people to a cause that they don't feel comfortable, for whatever reason, embracing or leading. But I think what we do, instead of like shaming those who haven't, we cherish and celebrate those who have, and few have done it to the extent that Bill Russell did it.
When Red Auerbach decided to retire after they won their eighth championship in a row, it's like, who can we hire to coach Bill Russell? Geez, you know, who could? He hired Bill Russell to coach Bill Russell as a player coach. And in that first year that he was the player coach of the team, they didn't win the championship. That was the great 76ers team that year that won 68 games. And, you know, Wilt led the league in assists. And I mean, it was like this whole thing that season. But in the following 2 years, his two final years in the league, he not only coached, but was the best player on two championship teams. That's a little thing that, you know, people of a certain age might remember, but, you know, one of the things I like to do when we do our show is try to connect maybe some of the younger people in the audience with stuff like that. I mean, I don't know that there's been a more successful player coach in basketball ever.
Well, Lenny Wilkins, I guess, not more successful, but that's the only other example I think that we can take seriously. And, you know, to be fair, also, they changed the rules to prevent that from happening again, that player, we don't have player coaches anymore. But it's particularly that last championship. I think, you know, one of the funny things, Bruce, is when people think about that Celtics dynasty and the eight straight and, you know, 11 out of 13, I think there's a feeling of absolute crushing dominance. And how could you not feel that way? Look, they're winning practically every year. But when you look at the details of each journey, you realize, man, they were clawing this thing out. They were clawing it out. And in many ways, that's another testament to the greatness. The idea that, look, when it became a single possession or kind of handful of, you know, you can count the possessions on your one hand that are just deciding this game and the series, they came out on top. They did the most right. They made the least mistakes. That's greatness too. But I think that's where you really start to really appreciate what Bill Russell was able to do, particularly in that one. Because if you think about that 69 championship, the last one, where it's game seven and it's in LA, they've gotten back to LA. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, Van Bredekhoff doesn't try to prove a point by benching Wilt at the end of the game, maybe we're not here. But again, the Celtics and Bill Russell put themselves in a position to take advantage of that. And there is merit to that as well. In the same way that when I tell people, look, in order for the Warriors to blow a 3-1 lead, they have to have been good enough to be up 3-1. And so rather than kind of chastise the Warriors for choking and, oh, I can't believe Kerr played all those guys in the fourth quarter and kept playing Harrison Barnes. And we need to say, wow, that's pretty incredible what the Cavs did, because they put themselves in a position where the Warriors made enough mistakes for them to take advantage of that. And Bill Russell and the Celtics and, you know, Bill in particular, especially as a coach, that's what they did in many of those championships. They were not dominant performances. They were, hey, this thing is going to come down to who makes the least mistakes, and I bet it's going to be us and not them.
Now, I mean, here as we head into our fourth quarter, want to have some fun with you that is relevant to the timing of our episode, and that is to kind of discuss our favorite Super Bowl commercials and what we thought of the overall game and things of that nature. So, Worldby, I'll start with you. Did you have a commercial in particular that stood out watching last night's Super Bowl?
The ones that I enjoyed the most were, what is it called? Pluto TV, that had the couch potatoes that they were raising.
Oh, yeah.
I got a kick out of that one. That was pretty good. And the Arnold Schwarzenegger State Farm commercial, that cracked me up too. That one made me laugh more than the other one. I thought the other one was pretty original, though. That was pretty cool.
Bruce?
Well, I would have to hand in my membership in the Boston Sports Mafia if I didn't pick the Dunkin's commercial with Ben Affleck, J-Lo, Matt Damon, and Tom Brady as my favorite. I mean, besides the general goofiness of these old dudes forming a boy band, we got to see the magnificent Jennifer Lopez, whose final words were, "Tom, you can stay." Now, I already love Dunkin' Donuts coffee, so I didn't need to be sold on the product, but you know, Boston. When Matt Damon dropped his "How do you like them donuts" line, I got such a Mini Driver vibe from Good Will Hunting.
Nice.
It wasn't on, just man. That. It was the apology. He apologized immediately after it. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, he said, "Being your friend isn't easy," or something like that. "You owe me whatever." It was just really, I'm still laughing.
That and as J-Lo dismisses Ben Affleck, he says, "You're seeing pinstripes too much. You're caught up in the pinstripes." So that was another nice little kind of nod to the Bronx-Boston connection between those two. I like the Dunkin' Donuts one. I like the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tommy DeVito. Wow. all the lines across now. Danny DeVito commercial. I did enjoy that. But my favorite was the Michael Cera one. It was just nice and silly. And that's what Super Bowl ads are supposed to be. Just be nice and silly. Make me laugh and sell your product. Some of these commercials, you're either trying too hard in terms of trying to be moving. The moving things rarely work, I think. Or they're trying too hard to lean on celebrity to be funny and wacky. I thought the Dunkin' Donuts one achieved that. I thought the State Farm one achieved that. And I thought the CeraVe one achieved that as well. So I think that one's my favorite. That's my number one.
So, you know, people are using the Dynasty label all of a sudden for the Chiefs. And I think that might be a bit premature. And actually, when Tracy Wolfson asked Patrick Mahomes about it after the game, he kind of seemed to agree with it. He said, "Well, yeah, you know, it's great, but, you know, we're still doing it. You know, we still got work to do." Now, it used to be that 5 championships by a group was required to be a dynasty. The Celtics, the Lakers, the Bulls, the Spurs, 5? The Yankees. Yeah. You know, the old Montreal Canadiens, the Patriots.
5's a lot.
But now the Warriors have 4, so they're there. We'll call them a dynasty. I mean, because they did it over a long period of time. But the Chiefs need one more to tie Golden State. I mean, has the term dynasty been devalued?
So let me ask you a question by your same rhetoric. So the Larry Bird in the 80s, that wasn't a dynasty then.
By Celtic standards, it really was not.
But I think the idea is, when we talk about dynastic, I think the idea is that you win a lot, but also you are in a position to win a lot. And you look at the Chiefs, under Patrick Mahomes. 6 years, six straight trips to the AFC title game. So you're in the final four 6 straight years. Yeah. Think about that in the context of any other sport. You got to the final four 6 years in a row, right? And then you won four of them. And one of the ones that you lost in the Super Bowl, actually you've been to the Super Bowl four times. So you won four of those AFC title games. You won three of them. The fourth one, it was Patrick Mahomes with basically paper mache as a line. I think, and now they've won back to back. I think when you look at this by any metric, this is an incredible run. In the same way, the Warriors, they only won, they quote unquote only won four. They also went to the finals. What is that? 2015 to 2022. Was that five times in 7 years?
They should have won five for sure. The year that Draymond got suspended, that should have been a one. That should have been their
That should have been their fifth. They should have maybe won six if everyone didn't, crumble into injury against Toronto. Yeah. So the idea isn't just, hey, how many did you win? It's realistically, how many did you have a chance to win? And we look at the Warriors, realistically, they had a chance to win six. They won four. They had a chance to win six. Realistically, the 80s Celtics, they won three. They had a chance to win five, right? Five, right?
Yeah.
So I think the Chiefs absolutely are a dynasty. By the way, Patrick Mahomes, that's how you answer that question. Are you a dynasty? Oh, we're not done yet. Calling things dynasties, that's for people looking backward. We're still looking forward for the next one. And he kind of said, he echoed something that Magic Johnson said a long time ago. He said when they won when they won the championship in 87, right? And they're celebrating and they're happy. And he said, out of the corner of my eye, I saw Larry Bird walking off the floor, right? And I saw the look in his eyes. And Magic said, I understood that we partied that night and we celebrated. We partied every night until the parade and we celebrated. We had the parade and we partied that night and we celebrated. And then the day after the parade, I went to the gym and I started working because I knew somewhere in the world Larry Bird is working too. Like that's the mentality. It's like, I have four, I want five. I have five, I want six. It's not like, look at how many I've won. It's I want the next one. I want another one and another one. And that's what separates, I think, the greats from the really goods. The really goods, oh, we won. All right, cool. My resume is cemented. And they're right. Their resume is cemented. But the truly great ones have a maniacal desire to keep adding. And I think Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce and Andy Reid have that. Now, the rest of the guys, their defense, can they keep it up and be as great a defense as they were this year? We'll see. We'll see if those guys have that same kind of hunger.
Now, I mean, to end the show here, I'm going to go off script, but being one of his biggest fans, I'm curious to get your thoughts on Blazers rookie guard Scoot Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a lot of people are worried out there as far as his debut season in the NBA after being this high draft pick and highly thought of kid that would obviously be the changing of the guards in Portland. How worried are you? Because if you ask me, who've watched a ton of Portland games trying to track him, I feel like once the mental game starts to slow down, a lot of what he's missing is going to start clicking. Of course, the shot's got to come around, but I think a lot of what is happening with him right now is the game is too sped up in his head. But very curious to get your observations on his season so far.
Ross, we're back to baking cakes.
Okay.
You gotta get the cake. Sometimes it goes through this period where you turn on the light, you look in the oven, like, ew, that doesn't look like anything I want to eat. Trust me, it's gonna get there, but you gotta wait. And people want immediacy, and people see other things happening in other places. And why can't it be like that? Why can't it be like Brandon Miller? He looks great already, right? Brandon Miller walked into the NBA with a definable skill. I can shoot, right? And not only can I shoot, I'm tall and I can shoot. Those are two things automatically that's like a bypasses a lot of problems that you might have as an NBA player. Scoot Henderson is playing the toughest position, I would say, not just only in terms of all the things you have to know how to do, manage clock and manage egos and manage all this stuff, but also the competition every night. there is an all-time great coming in here that I have to play against. So his path is going to be a little bit more difficult. You're right. The game is moving too fast for him. Now, if he were a great shooter, he can mask some of those things. Mm-hmm. He can overcome some of that with just the skill, not know what he's doing, but it, like, I'm going to hit shots, make shots, and lead us to some either victories or some great performances. If you're a point guard and you can't shoot in the NBA, every defense, every scouting report is like, make him shoot, make him shoot, make him shoot. And the problem with that is if you are a poor shooter and they say, let him shoot, and you miss, your confidence doesn't really go up. It goes down, and that tends to be a spiral. And that's for anyone, for 30-year-olds, let alone 19-year-olds. So I would say that all the things that I like about Scoot, he's exhibited, and you just have to wait. You have to wait for him to kind of get his feet under him and get a little bit understanding of the game and let the game slow down for him, and then also for his skill level to catch up to who he is as a player.
So if you were my NBA financial advisor, would you tell me to buy more Scoot stock or sell my Scoot stock?
I've got everything I got in Scoot stock.
Okay, so cool.
We'll see how it goes. Right there
with it. Awesome. Well, I mean, we've really had a lot of fun with you here tonight. I've appreciated all the analogies. I'm sure we will reference them at times. So hopefully you give us permission to get back to baking cakes and looking in the oven, because I'm sure that will come up from time to time later on the 48 Minutes podcast. But again, truly been an honor to have you on our show, and appreciate you coming on and showing your support.
No problem. Thanks for having me. And like I said, that cake one, that's an oldie. That was NBA Tonight era. NBA Count, maybe not NBA Count, the NBA Coast to Coast era.
Oh, yeah. My favorite show ever.
Yeah.
So with that,
God rest his soul.
So with that, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back with you next week to be sure you're up to date in 48 on all things around the association. Take care, everybody.